NPR News live, bringing you interviews with local activists, politicians, and policy experts from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Armand Rana. It's Thursday, the 27th of October at 4:08 p.m. We are broadcasting live from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Han Communion-speaking Musqueam people. Kind of switching gears here after the local elections coverage over the last few weeks, there's a lot of really important stuff happening in the world today. The war in Ukraine is continuing to unfold. You also have the continuing descent into chaos in Britain following Brexit. The situation in Iran is something we're hoping to cover more soon in the near future as well. Against this backdrop, a few really important stories remain undercovered. One of those stories is the recent murder of the journalist Percy Lapid in the Philippines. To learn more about this, today we are going to be talking to a few student activists here at UBC, about what they characterize as a return to fascism in the Philippines. So joining us in studio today is Kai and Nashreen of Silong UBC, an anti-imperialist Filipinx and Canadian youth and student group. Could you start off by sharing a bit more about yourselves, your organization, and what motivated each of you to join?
Kyra, do you want to start off?
Yeah, I got it.
Okay.
Hello, team. my name is Kai. I am the Secretary General of Sulong UBC. And Sulong UBC is, like you said, a progressive organization of Filipino youth, students, and allies at UBC, SFU, and surrounding areas. And we're all just struggling for national democracy in the Philippines. So we educate and organize through collective study, integration with our communities, mass campaigns like advocating for the rights and welfare of the Filipino students and youth workers, while also fighting for and amplifying the campaigns from back home, like defending press freedom, which is relevant to Percy Lapid, with the ultimate goal of achieving national democracy in the Philippines. So I'm also a recent UBC alum. Crazy. Didn't think I would make it, but here I am. and I was studying for my first 2 years, political humanities, poli-sci, historiography, all these things. When I came to UBC, I was studying, non-Western media, literature, art, and film, like this whole conglomeration of a bunch of things. And at the end of the day, in 2020 is when I kind of was thinking more about my heritage, my politics, like why I'm studying the things that I'm studying, and learning more about the Filipino history, the history of revolution, of resistance, of the people power uprisings, of, you know, the current situation right now. That's why I joined Sulong UBC, because we need to organize to address that.
We do need to organize. Yeah, I'm Nash, and I'm one of the campaign officer of Sulong UBC. Actually, I just recently moved to Vancouver a year ago, so I'm pretty fresh from all the experiences and youth in the Philippines. So the case with Percy Lapid, he's one of the famous cases in the Philippines, but he's not the only one who's experiencing the horror of like threat from the journalists from because of the government. So. Yeah, let's go.
But like, what motivated you personally to like, you know, get involved in you know, joining? You know, I was discussing, I think, before the show, it's not like, you know, people just say as a hobby, hey, I'm just going to, you know, casually join an organization like Sulong.
You know, one interesting thing about Sulong UBC is that this organization, it doesn't work by itself. If you go to the Philippines, there are a lot of national democratic organizations and movements, and I've been on it in a long time already. I grew up being an activist and being in a movement such as national democratic movements like Sulong UBC. So when I got here in Vancouver, it's a long story, but I got red tagged in the Philippines. And me moving to Canada is like my escape for that. But it didn't really stop me to continue serving the people and, you know, doing my service as a journalist and as a student activist. So I found Sulong UBC.
Is Is that experience of being red tagging something that you feel comfortable, you know, sharing more about?
Yeah, sure. It's not my first time broadcasting it anyway. And it was really a famous case in the city that I was in. So did you want me?
Yeah.
Okay. So I was in my university in Baguio City, and we were talking about organizing a walkout about the tuition hike and how our recent students who are experiencing some militant threats from the police and the military in Baguio. Because, you know, Baguio City is like a mountain, like, province. So in the Philippines, they usually look at the area that is vulnerable to a lot of, like, NPAs, or what they call communists. Because in the Philippines, that's illegal. So basically, like, they look at the students, activists, and journalists, or even the professors sometimes as, like, a terrorist. But it's not. Like, that's just a propaganda. So me, as a student activist, I was, we were organizing a walkout, and then I forgot to wear a mask. Because, you know, it was already scary. We took the risk. Like, every time we go out to the school, we always, like, tend to try to, like, disguise ourselves so they wouldn't recognize us in the public. But that time, it was, like, pretty urgent, and I just got out of a class, and I was like, okay, I have to go out. So I forgot to put on masks and everything. And then apparently there are police officers outside who are not in uniforms taking pictures of the students. And then the next thing I know, I woke up, I saw a post on Facebook from the police itself, like their department, warning about us that, oh, be careful about this group of students, they're terrorists. And then it's not just that, it got broadcasted to a bunch of media as well. And even our university that time, they're getting profiling, they're getting questions about who we are, because they don't know our name, they just know our faces. So yeah, we were pretty much on the spot for a couple of weeks. That was before the pandemic. And luckily we got support from the municipal mayor, so our case got laid low, and the police officers apologized to us, even in media, in front of the media. But then we realized that was just a publicity stunt. Because after a few months, when the pandemic hit, we had to go back to our own provinces and hometowns. The red tagging still continues. So they kind of gave information to the police in different provinces about us.
Thanks so much for sharing that. But I just want to really understand, like, this term red tagging. What does it actually mean? Could you kind of unpack it?
Sure. Yeah, red tagging is basically where state officials will identify human rights defenders, activists, student activists, teachers, lawyers, advocates, like anyone that is kind of dissenting against the government in any kind of way. And they will kind of use that sentiment of anti-communism, of terrorism, quote unquote, to target them, make that a case for extrajudicial killings, make it a case for unlawful detainment, make it a case for disappearances, you know? So it is a life or death situation sometimes, most times, when you're getting red tagged. And it's been happening. That's like a legacy that has continued from martial law period, way back.
Yeah, so could you expand, like, where does this originate, the implication? Like, it sounds like it has, you know, comes probably from the Cold War, but specifically in the context of the Philippines, what are the implications of being, you know, associated with communism or something like that?
Mm-hmm. Well, basically we're talking about this National Democratic Movement, right? And let's maybe start there first, like defining exactly what that is, because Sulong UBC has been red tagged in the past year, and people are like, oh, we're getting infiltrated, UBC is being infiltrated by terrorists and all these things. And we're like, we're literally just students trying to fight for basic human rights in our home country. But to go back again to talk about what the National Democratic Movement is, to be completely clear, It is fighting for national liberation and genuine democracy in the Philippines. That's what it means, right? And when we say that, that means like foreign policy that will serve the people of the Philippines before it serves imperialist interests from US or China or Canada or whoever. It means a democratic system of governance that will actually value, you know, a government that puts the people before profit, and genuine agrarian reform so that, you know, the farmers that feed our country can have, you know, sustainable farming practices or like actually reap the fruit of their labor, you know. So that's what we mean when it's national democratic movement. And this movement has been happening for decades. So like we say that it started kind of with the first quarter storm back in, oh my goodness gracious, dates, 70s? 70s, yeah. It was in the 70s where a bunch of university students were first going out, you know, advocating for tuition freezes, yes, that's the right word. And, you know, chanting these things of like, you know, down with U.S. imperialism because the people were suffering because of that, down with bureaucrat capitalism or that system where the country is run like a company because the people were suffering from that, down with feudalism because the people are suffering from that, right? So a lot of these students were out in the streets, like in masses, trying to do that. And then Marcos Sr., Ferdinand Marcos Sr., saw that as a threat, you know, to the, I guess the, can you, like.
He saw it as a threat because during his regime, he was basically, he's trying to control the whole country by his own fist, his own mouth, his own, his own policies. So, mm-hmm. like, when this activist and indie movement sees that there's something wrong from it, like, for example, how he tried to control military forces, which is, by the way, happening as well right now in the Philippines, mm-hmm. but in a more different way. So, yeah, they used that red tagging propaganda to stop the students and professionals mm-hmm. from calling him and his mistakes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit more about, because I think, you know, here in, you know, in Canada, I myself don't have a whole lot of knowledge of, you know, of the history of the Philippines. Mm-hmm. It kind of gets overlooked. So just, you know, the original Marcos, could you just give us a sense of, you know, how did he come to power, you know, as you described it, tried to, you know, rule the country with his own fist? And, mm-hmm. you know, how does that, you know, connect, or if does it connect at all to the current, you know, Marcos, who is now the president of the Philippines?
Yeah, I think we can talk kind of about. I'm gonna think of my words, right? So, like, even though Marcos Sr. and Marcos Jr. are huge obstacles to human rights in the Philippines, like huge obstacles to like genuine democracy, you know, actual liberation for our country. The system, like that, their being in power is a symptom of the system of imperialism, of capitalism, and of feudalism in the Philippines, like of the economic means of production in the Philippines, of how the Filipino government continues to serve foreign interests, how feudalism still has a chokehold over the entire country because 75% of the masses are peasant farmers, you know. So these systems are kind of what make it possible for people like them to come to power. And then there's also this, you know, you've heard of the U.S. installing presidents, right? In various countries that they still want to have a hold of, even if they're not colonies anymore, right? So. Historically, right, we say that the Philippines had 300 years in the convent, 50 years in Hollywood, because we had 300 years of Spanish colonialism. And then we had 50 years where the Spanish sold us to the U.S. in a mock battle as to be their U.S. colony. And then the U.S. so granted us our so-called independence. But we're not truly independent because they still have their imperialist influence over the presidents, what they're doing, the policies that they're making, you know, like all of these things. So that is kind of like the machinery, I guess, behind how it is possible for these presidents to keep coming back to power. Like, this is the literal son of the actual literal dictator, Ferdinand Marcos Sr., you know? And it's like, there's so much that was that, there was so, oh my gosh, there was so much behind that election. And like so many decades also of historical revisionism that went into that, of the U.S. government protecting Marcos in Hawaii when he was, you know, ousted.
So could you just talk, let's just start with the first one, because I understand what you're saying, that, you know, there's underlying conditions, you know, and we will talk about, you know, especially the U.S. role in a bit. But I just want to understand the, you know, the let's just talk about the Richard Marcos. How, like, you know, how did he come to power? And, you know, and when we say, you know, he's a dictator, I think, you know, a lot of people, especially in North America, kind of started to use those kind of terms very loosely. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll just say, oh, this guy mm-hmm. wants to install bicycle lanes, he's a dictator, mm-hmm. right? So yeah. I think, you know, just giving some sort of, what does it actually mean when we say Marcos was a dictator? What did he actually do?
I guess to look at it in the sense of, like, the Filipino community, they look at Marcos as a smart people, which, okay, I wouldn't deny he is really smart. Like, he wouldn't be staying in the position for that long while if it wasn't for his strategy. But the thing is, so when he was in the when he was the president of the Philippines, he was doing a lot of building projects. Like, for example, he showed the Philippines, he exposed them to technology, to like this huge bridges, like allocations of like he has a lot of projects that ideally gave the Philippines a heads up in the international picture for a couple of years. But then he realized that through those projects he can actually corrupt money from it. So this is what the Filipino people didn't see from his governance, which is why there's like a battle of, oh, whether Marcos is a hero or not. Because what he's the Filipino liked him, some Filipino community liked him because of how, because of the image basically that he portrayed for the Philippines. But then he started to put more money into the projects that he's making. So for example, if you're going to make a bridge, it's going to cost you, this is just an example, I don't know the total estimate, it'll cost you like maybe $3 billion. But on the paper, he's going to write in there that they will need a budget of, I don't know, $15 billion or $10 billion. So imagine where the $7 billion rest of the money comes from. And for a long time, he was like that until for the rest of 20 years, the professionals, the statistics, even the bank has been seeing the bulk of like money that's going to the like accounts of the Marcoses. But again, like the normal Filipino public, they don't see that.
Mm-hmm. If I can just add also, like, there was that happening, and by the end of his like time as president, or yeah, as president, I guess, he had embezzled like $13 billion, right, from the Filipino people and the Filipino government, which should have been going towards actual, like, sustainable development, social services, you know, any of these kinds of things. And then on top of that, the other reason why he is seen as a dictator is because under martial law, thousands of people died, thousands of people were disappeared, hundreds were, you know, yeah, like, hundreds were tortured. Like, we have our titos here in the community who experienced it, and you know, they speak openly with, I don't know how, actually, I really don't know how he's able to do it, but he will speak about his time being a student activist in the National Democratic Movement, having to go underground when martial law was declared. And that fear of, you know, that he was trying to impose fear through this martial law tactic. And then he would really go in, raid people's homes, take them away, bag them, you know, like, this is not him personally, but like, you know, the police, and like he would order this to happen. Yeah, the government. And like that is not what a democratic president would be doing, you know, like that No.
Yeah, he wasn't following the three governance in the Philippines, like the executive, judiciary, and all of those stuff. It doesn't exist during his time because he was basically the overall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks. So now coming to the role of, you know, international powers, I think you were alluding to earlier, mm-hmm. you know, the U.S. role, and I imagine more recently China also, you know, is playing an important role in, mm-hmm. in Philippines politics. What has been the role of, you know, international powers in, you know, perpetuating, especially, you know, strongmen dictators, mm-hmm. but also, the, you know, the issues around inequality that you described, and in terms of, you know, feudalism and, you know, treating the country as a business.
Mm-hmm. Well, we can, you know, the Philippines is strategically located, like, you know, in the Southeast Asia, you know, in the ocean, and it's like close to these land masses. There's fish. We have mountains. We have like lush lands and stuff.
Rich with resources. Basically.
We're rich with resources.
Minerals.
But yeah, minerals. Plants, like, you know, crops, all of these things. But, like, the people are still poor because of the exploitation of those resources by imperialist countries. And the way that also the Philippine government has been allowing that to happen, like, there are direct policies that say that foreign companies can have 100% ownership of public services in the Philippines right now. Like, there are, there's so many U.S. and Canadian mining companies that are ruining, like they are extracting, you know, and mining in indigenous ancestral lands. And with the typhoons that are hitting, for example, like just now, Typhoon Karding, like it was supposed to be an area that was naturally protected by mountains, right? And all of a sudden, that region is experiencing mass flooding because mining companies have been deteriorating the environmental, like the natural environmental protection. So it's like there are a lot of layers of that. On top of that kind of like the resource extraction, there's also the military aspect of it, where the Philippines, after supposedly becoming independent and not supposed to be a colony anymore, the U.S. still uses it as a military base, right? And so there's the Visiting Forces Agreement, which basically gives U.S. military, I forget the word, but they're not held accountable for their actions when they're in the Philippines. So, for example, we have Jennifer Laude, who is a trans woman who was murdered by a U.S. Marine, and he did not face any consequences for that. Like, he was held in, like, an air-conditioned little container for, like, mm-hmm. a couple weeks, maybe a couple months. And then he was, like, pardoned by, you know. So there are, like, these kinds of policies. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, we're talking about, you know, the U.S. role. I was just wondering, and also that, you know, the anti-communism, would it be a fair characterization that part of, you know, at least during the original Marcos, part of the motivation for supporting that was because of the anti-communism in the Cold War? Was there a Cold War aspect to the support of the original Marcos?
Can you be more specific about what do you mean about
that? Like, you know, the U.S. had wars in Vietnam and stuff mm-hmm. to stop the spread of communism.
Yeah.
They supported it. Well, I personally came from South Africa where they supported apartheid mm-hmm. to stop the spread of communism. So mm-hmm. I was wondering if would the U.S. support of...
I guess it's always been how U.S. works, you know? I mean, like these mother countries, even Canada is not a good country for, mm-hmm. you know, all these small countries.
Yeah. Personally. I think, like, ultimately, whether it was, I don't know, because there is a Communist Party of the Philippines, there's also the National Democratic Movement of the Philippines, and, you know, like, there are so many people, okay, the people of the Philippines are organized, basically, right? And Marcos could see that they were. And if the people got genuine liberation, the U.S. would no longer be able to have a stronghold over the Philippines. I don't know if that makes sense. My friend used, like, this, Kasama actually, used this metaphor of, like, milk crates, where imperialism is this massive you know, global structure of a bunch of milk crates with the U.S. standing on top. And if one milk crate, like one semi-colonial country, is kind of pulled out from under that, like the Philippines, if it's pulled out, like the U.S. and the imperial system will fall. So I think if we frame it more kind of like that, maybe it can give a better picture of like, why was it such a threat, you know, for there to be all of those like uprisings, like speak of revolution, speak of genuine liberation and stuff.
I guess because for presidents such as Marcos and Duterte, they always believed that the backbone of economy is international, like partners and, you know, the U.S. and China. That's why even during the Duterte administration, most of his build projects were funded by China. So it's not just Duterte, it's basically systematic, like it's everywhere. Mm-hmm.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to CITR News on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Arman Rana, and I'm speaking with Kai and
Nash.
Yeah. Who are students with Sulong, not students, one alumni with Sulong UBC, Anti-Imperialist Filipinx and Canadian Youth and Student Group. After a quick break, we'll be speaking with them on the recent murder of the journalist Percy Lapid.
And do you hate that greedy, soulless international conglomerates are succeeding in the cutthroat world of coffee? Sounds like local coffee roasters Trek Coffee is for you. Trek Coffee is 100% indigenous and military veteran owned and operated. Let's keep small businesses thriving. Stop by Sunshine Convenience on 4th, the Super Value on Commercial, or Grocery Checkout in the Nest to pick up some Trek Coffee today.
NormieCorp presents Chaotica, Volume 3, happening October 30th.
Expect heavy-hitting music, floor-to-ceiling visuals, and a spooky, sexy lineup like DJs Quirkill, Adam, Aina from China, and more, with live dance performances from Batty Banks, Kerajuku, and so many more. Go to the link in the NormieCorp Instagram bio for more details.
Slice of Life Art and Gift Shop is Vancouver's choicest destination for one-of-a-kind artist-made prints, posters, screen prints, riso prints, paintings, acrylic paintings, watercolor paintings, ceramic mugs, ceramic plates, ceramic bowls, ceramic pots, lapel pins, hats, toques, crochet bathing suits, jewelry, trinkets, knickknacks, hand-painted signs, curated thrift, and a bunch more stuff that won't fit in this designated block of airtime. Slice of Life Art and Gift Shop, located at 1636 Venables, just off Commercial, open 11 to 6, 6 days a week.
Are you looking for Halloween plans? The Forever Underdog Kids Club presents Monster Mash, happening October 29th at 7:30 at the Smiling Buddha Cabaret. Tickets can be purchased at the venue before the show, with a headlining act from musician Xavian, along with live music from Maya Ray, Trey Denzel, Max Green, and more. Plus, comedy acts, local pop-up shops, and a costume contest, with a prize for the winner.
In the context of Vancouver's opioid crisis, CITR would like to take a moment to share some harm reduction strategies.
Try not to do drugs alone. When going out, let friends know what drugs you're taking and make sure someone has an naloxone kit. If you're able to, get your drugs tested before taking them.
Avoid mixing opioids with alcohol or stimulants. Remember that opioids can include painkillers prescribed by a doctor, and it's possible for any drugs to be contaminated with opioids.
Learn the signs of opioid overdose, which include, but are not limited to, unresponsiveness or unconsciousness, inability to speak, breathing that is slow, erratic, or has stopped completely, heartbeat that is slow, erratic, or has stopped completely, skin tone that has turned blue or gray, choking or gurgling sounds.
If you think someone is overdosing, call 911 immediately. Start rescue breathing and administer naloxone if you have it. You cannot get in trouble for being on drugs, so always call 911 in an emergency.
For more information about naloxone kits and training, visit towardtheheart.com.
Thank you and stay safe.
Welcome back to CITR News 101.9 FM. We've been talking to Kai and Nash from Sulong UBC about the political situation in the Philippines. And we're going to shift gears a bit here and talk about the recent murder of a journalist, Percy Lapid. So could you give us, our listeners, some context? Who was Percy Lapid and what was his show Lapid Fire about?
Mm-hmm. So Percy Lapid, also his also other name is Percival Mabasa. He was a veteran broadcast journalist. He was a staunch critic of both the Duterte and Marcos Jr. administrations. And he would, like, you know, he was known for also highlighting the red tagging, like we talked about before, and the extrajudicial killings of critics and activists. So under Duterte's regime, with his show, he was one of the many journalists who exposed human rights abuses and corruption, such as the ex-president's bloody drug war, which is actually a war on poor people. And so he was, you know, opposing historical revisionism of the martial law era, which covered up or downplayed atrocities committed by the Marcos Sr. regime. And on October 3rd, he was shot dead near his home by a riding in tandem or like a motorcycle passing by in Las Piñas.
Yeah, so you said a lot there, actually. So just to circle back a bit, you said, you know, he was, you know, exposing the historical, you know, revisionism. Mm-hmm. What is this historical revisionism that you're talking about?
You know the show, the Lapid Fire? That's how he talks to the public about fact-checking and reporting to them about, you know, what is right and what is wrong, especially to the Marcos administration. But when it comes to historical revisionism, one reason, or let's say the significance that Marcos returned to power is to try and rebrand the Marcos family and how their governance worked in the Philippines. So far, as for the status quo, they're trying to look at the martial law era as the golden era of the Philippines, or they're trying to like erase even their crimes on about like not paying tax, excise tax, and all
the
of that.
The embezzlement, the torture, the disappearances.
Basically removing all of that from the books and narratives in the public in the Philippines. So yeah.
Yeah, and then the other thing you mentioned was, you know, the war on drugs of Duterte. What was that about? And why did you describe it as a war on poor people?
Yeah, I mean, I actually attended like the International Coalition for Human Rights in the Philippines had a congress in November, and we had a member from VANDU, which is the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, come and speak about how, like the war on drugs, whether it's here in the downtown east side or back home in the Philippines, like it is a war on poor people because, you know, drug use, substance use, like that is a systemic, like a systemic symptom, right? And it's kind of like, again, these band-aid solutions, not addressing what the real societal ills are of, you know, not high wages, capitalism, feudalism, imperialism, and all of these like systemic things, right? Like the band-aid solution was to blame it on drug users, drug dealers, kill them all, and our society will be healed, you know? Like that's what it was framed as, but clearly so many people died, nothing has changed.
Yeah, that's awful. So you know, coming back to, you know, Percy Lapid, I'm quoting now from Wikipedia. You know, he disclosed some irregularities regarding, you know, the sugar crisis in the Philippines, and this led to a resignation of Executive Secretary Vic Rodriguez. In September of this year. To what degree do you think his murder was connected to this particular scandal, or just the several kind of things that you said he would expose?
Vic Rodriguez, the resignation is actually quite expected, but I guess I wouldn't say it's an isolated case on like how Percy Lapid got murdered, but it's one of the most critical issues that the government has put themselves with. The Percy Lapid has the confidence to speak out to the public about it. So yeah, Vic Rodriguez, he's just one of the cabinet officials that has been, that was stripped down. But like, you know, even if Vic Rodriguez is not the current executive secretary, he's still in the government. Like, you know, during the Duterte administration, he has this tendency to put military officials and like allies in the government positions, even if they're not like knowledgeable about how politics works. So I feel like Vic Rodriguez is like one of the same people as well. You know, I wouldn't be shocked if like in 2 weeks from now or a month, Marcos would put someone in as his executive secretary that's like a Marcos supporter or, you know, a diehard fan or whatever.
Yeah. So. Totally. So true, bestie. But I think, like, you were asking about, you know, what is the links between Percy and, you know, the extrajudicial killings and maybe press freedom and all of these things. And his murder was like the second murder of a journalist under the Marcos administration in less than 100 days since he came into the office, right? And so with this being the second and also the 197th journalist killed in the Philippines since 1986, since after martial law already ended, right? Like, it is just like one of the most critical issues, again, that press freedom is like, it's not a right in the Philippines right now. Like, it's not practiced. There is constant repression of alternative media sources, constant targeting of journalists that dissent against the government or call out the government for human rights abuses, right? And so, you know, with all of this in mind, it's just, I learned recently from the National Union of Journalists in the Philippines that the Philippines is actually the 7th most dangerous country in the world for a journalist to live. And like that, I think, is one of the most crucial things that we could talk about. But that also relates back to the historical revisionism, right? So.
So I'm going to play an audio clip of President Marcos, if I can get it to work, on the on the death of the legend middleman in the murder. And I'm going to get you to respond to it. He's basically, just the rhetoric is very different in terms of how he's talking about, you know, journalism. I recall there was a quote I had from Duterte where he said, you know, journalists are not, exempt from being assassinated. Mm-hmm. Let me play this particular.
So we're investigating. I thought the report came back. Wala na o walang gamot na binigay ko sa namatay. I'm still not satisfied that it was natural causes. So some need to move it because there are ways to kill a person that do not show up in the medical legal. So to really follow the decision. But more importantly is to really trace saan ang galing ito, who gave the order, sino yung sino nagbigay dun sa preso ng ordering shooter na gawin ito at bakit. That is what you're working on.
Yeah, so he's, you know, saying, from what I understood, he's saying he wants to, you know, investigate and, and trace who is actually gave the order.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If there's one thing, Marcus and Duterte may be on the same principle when it comes to principles and governance, but they have completely different personality. Duterte is pretty out front, straight to the point. That's why when during his presidency, he's not afraid of, you know, putting out jokes that are actually they're actually targeting this woman, or even like jokes about killing people, or even like announcing vividly to the public that kill those poor people, kill those drug users, kill those journalists, versus Marcus. Because, you know, he's pretty much aware that his family is in the spotlight right now. So he's trying to make a low profile when it comes to like being the dictator. But Marcus has announced that he's going to continue the same thing that Duterte established, which is, you know, the shoot to kill, or, well, he didn't say specifically about the red tagging, but, you know, he's still doing it. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think to add on, it's kind of like, even if he's saying these things publicly, like we can see in the actions since his inauguration that he's not doing anything concrete to defend press freedom. He's not doing anything concrete to crack down on red tagging or persecute those that were involved in the extrajudicial killings from previously, right? Like, it's actually the opposite, where like news stations like Altimedia, Rappler, Bulletlat, like all of these alternative media sources that are trying to keep like objective reporting, not objective reporting. There's no objective reporting. Like, you know, like alternative,
investigative.
Like investigative reporting. Sure. That works. You know, like, yeah, like all of these other media sources that are providing an alternative to, like, you know, the mainstream thing that Marcos is channeling so much money into. Like, those are getting shut down or censored, or, you know, their spot is being lost. I also want to add...
Also, I guess because Percy Lapid is a really famous broadcaster. So, like, imagine killing a famous people. Isn't that going to be, like, a huge issue in the country, even in international context? Like, it got into you for a reason, because people were successful in protesting about his death. Like, he suddenly became the image of, oh, this is a danger in the journalists in the Philippines. So yeah, it's like one of the famous cases, but it's not the only cases.
Yeah, that's understandable. So given that it is a, you know, a high profile case, you know, what do you think? Do you think there's this investigation? The police have named, you know, several politicians as names of interest in this case. How independent is the police force, and do you think there will be justice in this case?
Yeah. So then the investigation started at October 4. And, you know, knowing the Philippines, they don't really trust the investigation from the Philippines. So when the PNP, or the Philippine National Police Department, did the investigation, Commission on Human Rights as well did their separate investigation and tried to compare the story and the plot that's like, you know, ongoing based on the Percy's case. So how independent it is? Well, so far, they're on the same line, probably because all the media are looking at them, so they can't really do anything, you know, doubtful, or any, they can't say something that's inconsistent. But one thing that happened is when Joel Escorial, which is the alleged shooter of Percy Lapid, went in and confessed. He basically gave some names to the department, to the police, about, oh, these are the people involved in the killing. One of the person involved is a Bilibid inmate. Bilibid is like the how do you say prison? It's like a huge prison in the Philippines. So one of the person involved is an inmate named June Villamor. And so when he exposed him, the next day after he was reported killed. No, not killed, but he died inside the prison. But it got reported like 2 days after. And the police didn't really report it that, you know, like it took a separate thing for it. So they're hiding some details to make it less threat, I guess, to the image of the police.
Yeah, that's very disturbing. So, what do you think? I think you've touched on it earlier, but you know, what do you think, his death means for, journalism, in the Philippines, at large?
Yeah. Well, I'm not gonna lie, it's terrifying. Like, it's really scary seeing the situation in the Philippines, right? With when it comes to journalism. But at the same time, we recognize that there are so many organizations that are on the ground, engaged and integrated with the masses of the Filipino people, with the communities, talking one-on-one, right? That's how we organize here. That's how they organize back home too. And there are a lot of organizations that are putting out statements that are, doing investigation and research, not just about this, but about the conditions in their in their barangay, in their streets, in their neighborhoods, in their provinces. And it's kind of we have to know what are the sources that we can trust, what are the sources that we can't trust, right? So I think if we just continue to read alternative media sources, continue to share alternative media sources, and that includes Bulatlat, Rappler, Alter Media, but then also the statements that are being put out by community-based organizations, mass organizations in the Philippines, because they're seeing, fake. I'm holding up my hands. You can't see my hands. They're seeing right here.
We need to switch to video.
there are sources. There are people that are really trying to put the truth out. There are people that are fighting, vigilantly, fearlessly for justice, despite the situation of journalism, despite the threat of extrajudicial killings, despite the threat of red tagging, from all of this machinery, the NCF, LCAC, the police forces, blah, 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 blah. There's so much, but there are still people out there that are really fighting for the truth to be put out.
The death of Percy Lapid actually organized a bunch of Filipino people. The way they protested about him, the way they tried to fight about the press freedom. So I guess Percy Lapid is one of the huge cases that triggered the Filipino masses to actually stand up and do something about it. Mm-hmm. The police and the House of Representatives, or even Marcos saying that speech, they won't do all of that if it wasn't for the people that he united because of what happened to his case. So yeah, I guess in a general scale, if these journalists were being attacked, killed, or red tagged, it's fueling the Filipino masses with their anger and frustrations about liberation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think we're coming to the close of the show. Is there anything else you'd like to share or bring up about your organization or anything else that you think is worth highlighting?
Yeah, I think just at the base of this, there's so much going on, and we can talk about current events all the time, and the elections, and this president coming to power after this president, who was also not the best for the people, but. I just want to share that, Sulong UBC, Anak Bayan Canada, Bayan Canada, all of these mass organizations, national democratic organizations, we understand that the solution to all of these things that are happening, to the current events, to the current political conditions, socioeconomic conditions, exploitation of workers, the solution is national democracy, which again is national liberation and genuine democracy, genuine agrarian reform in the Philippines. And I think with everything, with the potential return of martial law, with the active red tagging, with journalists being killed, we just have to remember the chant that was used really often during the People Power Uprising, which is Maki Baka Wag Matakot. Which means,
Makibaka means rise up. Wogwatakot means don't be scared. Mm-hmm. Be with the masses, y'all.
Yeah. And us youth especially, like the Secretary General of Anakbayan Philippines told us that the youth have nothing to be afraid of. So I would just encourage people, if you're listening right now, if you care about liberation mm-hmm. in any sense of the word,
like, don't be scared.
Don't be scared.
We're all on the same side.
Yeah.
And this, all these organizations are just all around you. Feel free to.
Mm-hmm. The people united will never be defeated, baby. Mm-hmm. Join Sulong UBC.
Let's go.
Thanks so much. Yeah. So, that's brings us to the end of today's show. The music you heard was Song of the Meese by Sarah Pratt. And you can find CIT News on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. So check it out there. And we're probably going to turn this into a podcast. So you'll be able to listen to this again there if you didn't get enough the first time. thanks again
Thank
so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having
Thank
us.
Thank you.
The Filipino people needs more representation. So this is a huge favor for that.